me how this all came about.
Okay, well, let's go back a few years to the first thing that we did many years ago. We were teaching classes. We gave all the people going through our class at that time free help up until the time they bought a business. And because of that, we had a lot of feedback. And the feedback basically was people were really afraid of the price, or they weren't getting the right value, or they're overpaying. And so I sat down, and over a period of a couple of years, I developed a mathematical equation, or equations called weighted values, to come up with a value of a business. In fact, it worked so well that right from the day we started doing this 25, 30 years ago, the IRS and the Small Business Administration adopted our program. Of course, the IRS did, because we were at an IRS-approved seminar. IRS agents had to attend our class to get promoted and stuff like that, so it was interesting.
The IRS, how did that all come about?
I don't have any idea. I think they heard about it. In fact, I could probably spend an hour or so just showing you programs that have been changed with the IRS because of them attending our class, because they got an insight into what business owners are doing. Because I had to show buyers what the sellers are doing to keep them from getting shafted by the seller in the transaction. So the IRS agents enjoyed coming. Again, we'd have three or four in a class. I still remember the one in Washington, D.C., when the guy showed up. I remember with his three-piece pale blue suit on, sat in the front row, and every time he leaned forward, I could see his gun in his holster. And he had told me during break that he was not only with the IRS, but he was the head of their enforcement division. That was a good thing. So what happened is, up until working with you about a year ago, when you suggested that maybe I start working with buyers, because I had complained to you about the fact that in all years in Mexico, we had developed millions of dollars in investment dollars. And then when I sold out, I really didn't move too fast to get involved in business again. So I had these people calling me every month. Well, again, I had not worked with buyers before directly, the office had. And so going out and doing this, I spent a lot of time on the phone and in person talking to different people, trying to explain to them the subjective stuff that I had in my head. In other words, I've been doing this for 50 years. I knew what I was doing. I knew all the details and what to look for. But I was having a hard time putting it across, because even with 25 basic categories, I'm sure I didn't cover all 25 with everybody. But just taking a few of them and covering them took a lot of time, which means I bored them, because if you look at something like this, if I took all 25 and sat down with a new buyer and went through all 25, he'd be asleep by the time we got through five. So what I did is I sat down and developed this program. And again, we're not using weighted values. I did not go into great mathematics. All we have basically is each of the 25 categories.
Can I ask you this for anyone who doesn't know, what is a weighted value? What does that mean?
I take the complete price that a business pays. I basically work the thing backwards, like re-engineering or taking something apart. What I did is I just worked the thing backwards and then took all the areas that made up business values, and then based on the importance in the total, we ended up with a weighted value. It's really very simple, but the only problem was trying to break the thing down, which took me a couple of years.
All right, so how is a buyer going to benefit from understanding this checklist?
Okay, they can do a better job of analyzing the business purchases, what I said on the sheet. But the key thing is, the average buyer does not know what they're really looking for. They don't know, on a scale of, say, 1 to 4, how important each one of the things is. What happens is, when they get down to the end, and let's say they take all 25, they circle the different things there, add up the numbers, they'll then end up with a score. Now, one of the first persons I came back recently was a college professor, and he told me the business he was buying scored an 86. I said, that's great. He said, that's a 3.6 grade point average. So it's a B+. I said, I don't think we're going to be using grade point averages, but it was an 86. And again, the thing that's important, it gives them a chance to compare this number with other businesses they're looking at. So they'll say, I have an 86, I'm looking at a 70, I'm looking at a 40. And what we're hoping to do is get them away from the ones that don't score too well, because those aren't the businesses they want to buy. Also, from the standpoint, if they come to me and want me to get investors interested, they have to have a business that has a higher number, because when I'm out talking to the investors, there may be three or four different businesses that we're trying to provide investors for. In doing that, if somebody has an 86 and the other people are in the 70s, the 86 is going to go immediately. So we're getting a lot of benefit from it. But again, it's helping the people that are buying the companies, first of all, as to what they're looking for. Again, we don't really have to have the thing being a B or a C or anything like that. It's just a comparison of one business to another. Now, the other thing that's important, and I've talked to a few buyers about this, when they are out looking at a business and say the thing comes in at 70, well, it's very easy to go through the 25 categories and figure out what they can do with the seller to improve the value of this company. Again, it doesn't really mean you're increasing the value, but increase a possibility that the investors are going to invest, because the buyer wins if the investors come in, and so does the seller. If they have too low a number, the chance of them getting an investor either from us or anybody else is little or none. So it gives them a chance. I talked to them about it. They can go back category by category. Maybe on owner financing, there's no owner financing. There's three categories there. And if the owners are willing to come up with owner financing in those three categories, and they're willing to go to the extreme, to the best, it's going to add a lot of value to the company.
All right, well, we're going to get to all those. Let's talk about how we're going to use this business evaluation program before we get into it.
Okay, well, basically, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to use it as a teaching tool. In other words, when buyers first come in, instead of having me spend the first hour going through a lot of these different details, they get this first, they get to look at it, and then as we go on, we can go on with the different things. But so far, nobody I'm working with has had any problems analyzing or figuring out really what it says, or the plus or minuses. It's just like on the pricing we came up with years ago. Even if they didn't use it to price, it showed them in 25 categories what gave businesses value and what took it away. Now what they're looking at is, will this business qualify for an investor? In other words, will an investor $1 million up or more on this deal? And so that's what they're really looking for. They're looking for something with a high score that's going to enable them to interest investors in doing this.
Let's keep a goal in mind. What do we need point-wise for us to have a good chance of having an investor invest in the business?
But there is no number I have in my mind. It's going to depend on what the buyers, the buyers that are going to the investors are scoring at the time. In other words, an 86 may be good today. A couple of weeks from now, they may be all in the 90s, or it's going to be. All I'm saying is, as I go out, the investors are going to have this as a guide. And what the investor had before, he had a business plan. He looked at the business plan and said, God, I'll either put the money up or I won't. Now he has an additional thing. And I want to tell you something from the buyer's standpoint and the seller's, this is going to make it more difficult for them to get their business financed, or an investor to come in, because the investor, instead of just looking at 50 pages of whatever, he's going to be able to look at 25 different items that's going to tell him the good news and bad news of 25 categories of this business he's looking at. And he is going to be much better prepared to make this decision, and it behooves the buyer and the seller to do a better job of putting this together.
Right. It sounds like a great tool. Let's go through all 25 of them and expand on them a little bit for the benefit of both the buyer and the seller.
But just keep in mind, this is a very simple thing. Each one of the categories, when people are going through this, they just circle a plus number after each description that applies, add the 25 up, and they have a score, which is a number out of 100.
Okay.
Let's take the first one, non-competition agreement. Now, I was going to put this further down, except I've had a lot of problems with this lately. And what happens is the normal non-competition, where the seller says he's not going to compete with you for a certain number of years for a certain area, is usually 5 years. That's normal. When you get down below 5 years, you have to be suspicious because there's something wrong with this. Example, a guy who's only going to give you 2 years non-competition. Well, I have one, as you know, I've been working with the last couple of months, where we have a person that will not go over 2 years on a non-competition agreement, but he is also a guy that, based on past experience, doesn't appear to have followed the non-competition agreement. In other words, he seems to take off immediately and gear up to compete with you, even though he's charged you a high price for his agreement for the non-competition. So if it's not 5 years, you have a problem. And what we're trying to do is isolate that right now. Now, owner staying. One thing we always worry about is how long an owner is willing to stay. A lot of owners will stay. I'll stay up to 3 months, maybe as part of the purchase price. But what happens is when you're in there, if there's one owner and he's going to stay 3, 4, 5 months, that's not too bad. What happens is when you have more than one owner, you have to start getting the average up around 6 months, or you're not going to be able to bring people in, train them to take those jobs. What I have found recently, I have one I've been working on over here in Huntington Beach, and that owner right from day one was willing to save for 3 years. I'm working with, as you know, the guy I was talking about, the college professor. The one he's working on, he has two owners. Now, the last time somebody else had worked on this, the owners were leaving immediately. Well, in 2 or 3 months. I don't know what he's done, but the owners now have agreed to stay for a 5-year period. Now, investors come in for 5 years. With him having this set up now, that both owners are willing to stay for a 5-year period, that basically when an investor comes in, there's been no change. I mean, we have a new owner, but everything else about this company that's made $2.7 million last year is the same. So it's important how long they're staying.
What have you found through your experience? Do most owners want to take off, or are they willing to stay for some time?
The key thing I have found is how you treat them. I do not go out and try to negotiate. In other words, I try to find businesses and go after businesses that are pretty close price-wise, terms, and what I'm looking for. Then when I get to the owner, there's very few things for us to discuss. In all the years I've been buying companies, I have never had an argument or a mean word between myself and the seller of a business. And again, you know how I am.
Right.
That would not be unusual to have me being that way, but I've never had that problem. The seller and I usually get along. And up until a couple of years ago, probably 10 years ago, I never even considered having an owner stay for a longer period. And I don't know what the percentage is, because I'm going back to figure it out, but in the last 10 years, probably a majority of the owners have stayed for 3, 4, or 5 years on business that I'm buying, which makes them more valuable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely nothing's changed. I mean, even if I'm an idiot, everybody's staying. As long as I stay out of their hair, the thing's going to continue cranking along.
That's right. I didn't realize that. I just, in my mind, thought the business is sold, the owner's out of there, and it's your baby.
It depends on what you negotiate.
Right.
The next one, which has the number of owners or managers leaving, what we used to say years ago, you went back to pricing. We figured this mathematically. Once you get up to about two owners or more, and them leaving with any short period of time, I say under 6 months, the failure rate goes back up to about the same as it would be for a startup company. So every time I see two owners, I'm always worried about them leaving, or owners or managers. So what I'm saying is, if you have one owner leaving and you have enough months, that's fine. If you start to have two, it has less value. And then when you get up to around three or four, you really have a problem. You're going to say, well, God, that's not much different. Well, it really is. You're getting twice the score for one person leaving as you do for three. And believe me, these numbers do work out as you get up toward 100.
Now, is this all negotiated in the purchase?
Yes. Everything is negotiable. No matter what people think, when you go in there, you can negotiate anything you want. And it's very easy, especially if you spend some time. In other words, we suggest you spend 2 to 4 hours in your first meeting with a seller or sellers. Get to know them. Even though it's going to probably have 3 or 4 hours, you spend 15 minutes discussing the details. You don't want to spend 3 or 4 hours discussing the details as opposed to 10 or 15 minutes, because you grind on each other. So what you try to do is get to know each other, and the more the buyer and seller get to know each other, the better the deal is going to be.
If you negotiate this up front, and this is all in the contract, what happens if someone leaves? Let's say the business has been sold and someone takes off. Has that ever happened?
No. This is why when we were in the seminar business, everybody would come in and have all these things about things that were going to go wrong in buying a business. And so I suggested for years now that they take a yellow sheet of paper off out of their pad and write down all the reasons that they're not going to succeed in business, and why they couldn't do it in the past, and what's going to go wrong. And as soon as you write this up, put it in your desk drawer or put it in your safe deposit box. When you take over your first business, take it out, and you'll find out that none of these things ever happened. All the information that the average person buying a business has been given to them by all the losers of the world. I mean, the real losers. Because the only one you ever hear about out there saying anything is some person that screwed up their business. The media doesn't want to cover somebody that's successful. They want to cover the loser. So we get all this information. This is worldwide. So everybody has all this information. And all the stuff that's kept them from succeeding is a lie. It's not true.
Okay, well, that's good. That's number three. And when we go through these, Art, let's give them the number. So we're on number...
That was number three.
Right.
Okay, number four, the net profit, EBITDA, cash flow. You're talking about the multiplier for price. And again, I don't really care what you use. We're not trying to be that accurate in what we're doing here. We're trying to find what an average is. And what happens is, most businesses, and again, we have a pricing system you can go through, it'll take a long time. What we start to do, once you get by using the pricing system, we suggest that you start to think about multiples. In other words, businesses are basically priced at so much times the net profit. That's usually what you run into. Now, one of the problems I had before I put this together, it would take me hours just to go through this part of it, which I'm giving you right now, which makes it simple. Number one, manufacturing. And this is based on all my experience, and this is what you're going to run into all over the world, basically. Again, including the people I'm working with in Australia, because I talked to them about it, and they had sent me a long email outlining all the things they're running to in Australia. And I went back to them and said, you're not going to believe this, but everything's the same as in the United States, India, and probably on the moon. Okay. Manufacturing, over five times net. What you're going to run into is most manufacturing businesses are somewhere between four and five times net. That's the way they run. Now, when you get over five times net, you're going to find two things happen. Number one, the arithmetic doesn't work out. In other words, the return you're getting for the investors or on your money doesn't work very well. Also, when you get over five times net, if you're working with a broker that's selling it, he's going to tell you that this is a synergistic sale. And so they have priced it at six or seven times net, and they're only not after a regular investor, they're after a person that's already in the business. Well, you can give the broker a big hug around his throat and tell him from Hamel that he's lying through his teeth, because they, the brokers say, well, we can get a higher price by going to somebody that's already in the business. That's a lie. The person that's already in the business is not going to pay market. They're going to try to pay less than market, in spite of this lie. Now, most of the people I work with get involved in manufacturing. And again, very few really run into under four times net. They're usually in the range of about four, a little over. Now, when you're looking at this, the difference in the different nets in manufacturing is if they have a proprietary product, in other words, a product that they sell to the world, and they're selling under their name. In other words, it's the Arthur Hamel widget. Okay, which they use. That's a proprietary product. I then have a sales organization, and I'm a master of my own destiny because I can drive the sales myself. Now, as you get down towards four times net, most of the ones you're going to see in that category are ones that are subcontractors. In other words, they make a part for my widget. Okay, and their sales are going to depend on how good I am at selling my product. Actually, it's much better to have a proprietary product unless you don't like sales or marketing. Again, I'm not going to say you're not going to find a business out there that's priced at six times net and they're a subcontractor. But all I'm saying is, if you want to get points, you have to stay in this range. I think people should realize when I'm talking about these nets. Can you find other type nets, higher, whatever? All I'm saying is there are great, fantastic, outstanding businesses that fall within the category of either a plus three or a plus four. And so why the heck would you, in your right mind, go after something where you're paying much more for it?
It's just overpriced.
That's right. It's overpriced, and you're being stupid. Now, next thing in the same category is distribution, because we have four categories, number four. We have manufacturing, distribution, retail, and service. When you get distribution, again, they're lower on the scale, because what happens is, out there, the more risk you have, the lower the value. In other words, the lower the multiple. The least risky in everyone's mind that I work with for the world is manufacturing. There's less competition, less failure, things like that. Distribution is the next category. And again, it runs from anywhere from under four times net to maybe 4.5 times net. In other words, they're on the lower side of a manufacturing company. And a distribution company is harder to run. As you work in different parts of the world, you're going to find you can't get them really regularly financed, because the average bank outside the United States does not understand distribution. They say there's manufacturing and there's retail. Who's in the middle? Well, I've been in the distribution business, and for those of you listening, I just want to tell you, you're really caught in the middle, because the manufacturer is going to pick on you, have you pay a higher price. The retailer is going to be trying to drive your price down. And when you're sitting in the middle of distribution, it really is tough to make a living. And those are not the greatest companies to own. But they are better than retail businesses. Now, retail businesses, again, have higher failure rates. And you can see, because of the risk factor and the difficulty in running these things, they have lower net multiples on the average. Now, again, I'm not trying to get into a battle with anybody over what the net should be or whatever. In other words, we're not going to do this mathematically. We're doing it basically as a comparison within each category. And so when you look at these categories for number four, just look at it being manufacturing, you're going to pay the most for every dollar of cash flow. Distribution a little less, retail less, and then service businesses the least. And the reason for that is when you get into service, they are very risky, very risky. And the reason for that is, let's say, when you're in manufacturing, part of your income comes from the efforts of people. The other comes from the machines. The machines are pretty stable. Once you get into a business and you have all your profit generated by the efforts of people, you're going to drive yourself nuts. These are the toughest companies to run. They have the highest failure rates. But you can get into them for less money. What's your chance of making that money continuously? A lot less than manufacturing. But again, you have good news, bad news. You can't imagine, Michael, how much time I would spend with people just trying to explain this verbally on the phone and not sending anything to anybody.
Yeah, well, we had done it in another interview where we talked that products are a lot more reliable than people.
Right. Competition, number five, very important. We're looking for something where we have no competition. Now, again, your chance of finding a business is absolutely no competition. There's really none. But when I'm talking about no competition, I'm talking about no visible competition that is really giving you a hard time in that area. Minimum competition. The worst thing is extreme competition. You're going to say, well, God, I'm a fighter. I want to go out there. I want to be in a business with extreme competition. Well, all I can tell you is if you're in an area where you have extreme competition, you're going to find it's going to be difficult on a year-by-year basis to continue making that profit. And what you ought to think about is instead of being macho or macha, I think that'd be a female, what you ought to consider is finding a business that's easy to run, makes good profit, and does not give you gray hair or the manager gray hair. So just keep that in mind. Now, years in business, again, you're going to find the longer they've been in business, the less risk there is. I mean, if they've stayed around for over 10 years or over 15 years, the chance of you screwing them up going in or the buyer going in and screwing them up is very small. Because you already have a complete staff of people that have been there a long time. You usually have somebody running it that's been around probably 10, 15 years. It works very well. So I'm always looking for over 10 years. Once we get up to 10 years, it's something that I normally look at. Over the years, have I bought any that were under 10? I don't recall. I doubt it. Most of them today are over 15. Now, remember on the first one I was talking about non-competition?
Yeah.
I wanted 2 years. Well, here was a business that was around under 5 years, only been around four. This guy not only has been in business 4 years, but he only wants to give you 2 years non-competition because he's going to go out and slice your throat. This type person is. So years in business is important.
Okay. Number seven.
Number seven, number of employees. This is self-evident. If you haven't had a number of people to manage, you haven't lived. Again, what you're trying to go after is a range. We're usually talking about somewhere between 30 and 50 employees. When you're under 30, there are businesses out there that are under 30, say it's a four, but it's usually a donut shop or something like this, and they have six employees or eight employees. But in the businesses we work on, we're in a range of 30 to 50, and all I can tell you is I've had 30 and I've had over 50, and it's a heck of a lot nicer to be under 30 as far as being able to manage them and other problems that you have also. But again, anybody that thinks that maybe we're in the wrong order here, all you have to do is run into a couple of business owners and ask them what they think and see who agrees with whom. Okay, number eight, employee turnover year. What you're trying to do is you're trying to find out of the number of people you have, how many people left, if you want to just make it simple. We have 100 employees, and 20 of them left. So we had a turnover of 20% of the people.
In the year.
Right, that's in the year. Most companies will tell you what their turnover rate is per year because they know what it is. What we're trying to do is find one that's under 10, and you're going to say, well, how about an employee turnover of zero? Well, I can't believe that you have a company that has under zero. Now, in the companies I've had, we've had very little turnover, but it's not very difficult to get up to 10 for retirement, getting fired, all sorts of things. People move on to other things. So what we have is here a range of turnover. Again, the more turnover you have, the more difficult it is to run the company.
And it shows you there's signs, there's stuff going on in the company.
Yes. If you're over 20 and all you're getting is a one, you have more problems than our values here. And that's what is important on this. People have to look at this from a standpoint of practical. In other words, Hamill is giving us a message here. Not only would the investors do it, but you as a buyer shouldn't do it. Or if you're the seller, you ought to work on something to improve the situation so that the buyer doesn't fail. Okay, type of market. I will be changing growth of over 15% a year, which is the best. That's the growth rate. In the business we've worked on, I work absentee. In other words, I have somebody running the company. I oversee that person, say chairman of the board. I don't have a title like that, but I just oversee whoever's running the company. I stay out of that person's way. I spend all my time working on the growth programs, increasing our sales and marketing. I let the person running the company run the company. And I'll tell you something, when you're running a larger company and you're doing it full-time, you don't have time to be working on growth programs, increasing sales, other than working with your sales department. So that's what I do. And my goal every year is 25%. Is 25% difficult to get? No. I always tell people that 10% is a snap. In fact, when I have salespeople, I will tell them, say, look, I'm going to open the window in the front in the office. I'm going to open a window in the back, a manufacturing area, and I'm going to put all the order forms on a desk in front of the window. The wind in the back is going to blow through the plant, blow over the papers, and blow the order forms through the window out into the street. People will come along, pick up the order forms, and sign them, bring them in, and our sales will go up 10% a year. 10% to me, growth is ridiculous. It means you don't know what the hell you're doing. We always set our standard at 25 or more. I set up incentive programs so that the people that are earning based on 10% growth now can double or more the amount of income they have. In other words, it's sharing time. And do they hit it? Yes. Is it that difficult? No. Especially when you don't have other things you're working on. I mean, other than talking to you, Michael, I'm not very busy. Okay, the age of the industry. Again, what we're trying to avoid are new industries. And you can say, God, I want to be the first one in there. Yeah, sure you do. What you want to do is be in industries that have been around a while. The industries that have been around a while, and I'm not talking about the steel industry, are ones that are a lot safer. The failure rate goes down depending on how long the industry has been around. So 10 years is a good point, because when you're looking at plus four, that's what I'm really getting people to try to aim for. In other words, let's see if we can have plus four in every category. Then if you have a 3, 2, or 1, make that the exception. Okay, local economy is something that nobody ever considers. Declining local economy versus the dynamic. Well, what's going to happen is if you're out there working an average number of hours and that you have a declining economy, what's going to happen is you're going to be working a normal number of hours, or your people are, and your sales and profit are going to fall. Not because they're not doing a good job, the economy's dragging them down. On the other hand, by just going out and working an average number of hours and average speed, if you have a dynamic local economy, your sales and profit are going to go up.
Now, how do we find out about the economy in an area?
Well, you're going to have to talk to the Chamber of Commerce. You're going to have to talk to the owner. But again, nothing, the owner will normally know, will always know. But you also have to verify it. So you're talking to the Chamber of Commerce. You're talking to different other people. Besides, in any town you're working in, you're probably going to be working in a city. By the time you buy one, you'll have to talk to at least 2 or 3 business owners in the same economy. So you're going to get a pretty good cross-section. It's not very difficult. The national economy, number 12, again, depending whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it's either growing or dynamic. So basically, it's going to be what you've read. Again, most of the people I work with do read the newspaper. If you're a buyer, hopefully you are, so you know basically what the national economy is doing. And so you're going to put down growing or dynamic, or if we're in a recession, which we went through before. Again, what it does is it makes it more difficult. You're in a recession or stable, it's more difficult to drive your sales and profit. You want outside influences that are going to benefit you. Local labor market, number 13. This can drive you nuts, because I'm down in Orange County in Southern California. And again, I always know different restaurant owners, and they tell me that they have trouble every day of the week trying to staff their tables. And that's why most of the restaurants down here, you see empty tables, even though people are waiting, because they don't have enough waiters or waitresses.
Oh, really?
Yes. And the ones that we do have in Orange County have to drive from outside the area. And again, when I was up in Northern California, in Saratoga for years, there are the same problems up there. In fact, when I had offices in San Jose, I had employees that I transferred down from San Francisco, and I had to give them a cost of living adjustment up. It was more expensive to live in San Jose than it was San Francisco. I'm sure it still is. Of course, relatively, they're both very tough. Okay, so what we're looking for is we're many applications for employment. In other words, we have 10 openings a year, and we have 50 applications. Many unemployed, again, you say, God, if I put the people down, but there'll be more people available. So what I'm saying is local labor market, what you're looking for his ease of being able to hire people. And also, if there's a lot of people in the market that are looking for jobs, you're not going to have to pay as much. Put that down. It's just that you don't have to offer bonuses of $1,000 or $5,000 if somebody brings you something. If people haven't been in business before, they ought to go back and look at these 25 after they buy their first one, and they'll chuckle to themselves as they think, God, this is really common sense.
No, it is. No, you've just categorized and laid them all out.
The labor union.
14.
Okay. Now, what you're really looking for is no union. Number four, we try to avoid unions. If I have had a union plant, I don't remember it. Years ago, back in New York, as a consultant, I did some work with the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, with those type unions, and I couldn't believe how tough they were. So if you have strong union, competitors do not belong. I'm giving one of the few zeros I have to give. Now, what you're looking for is no union or a weak union. And what's going to happen is, it's just like anything else. You're going to say, I want to own a business. I want to be the master of my own destiny. Well, you're not going to be because, number one, you're going to have your wife and the government telling you what to do if you're a male. And then what you're going to find also, if you have a union, they really control you. You can't fire people. You can't hire people. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't improve your operations. I have very few good things to say about unions, but I'm not going to go into my union experiences with the machinist group out in California and Little Steel back in Ridgeway, Pennsylvania, where they smashed all the windows in my car. But that's another story.
Okay, we'll do that another time.
Ease of management. Again, going back to the same thing we talked about before that had to do with net multiples, in that the service business is the toughest to run. The manufacturing is the easiest to run. No matter how many employees you have, you're going to find things go better with Coke and with, well, Pepsi also, I guess. Things go better with manufacturing, distribution. Again, when you get down towards service, they are very tough to run. It is very tough for managers to run those companies. So a scale of 1 to 4, we say go for manufacturing. Working with our investors is easy because most of them own manufacturing plants. So I'd mention that. 16, net profit. Again, as you know, our minimum is $1 million. But that is not high on our scale because that has been our scale over $1 million for 25 or 30 years. I mean, if you tie inflation in, I don't know what the number should be today. But what we're looking for today, best category, is over $3 million. Seems like a lot of money, but it really isn't. They are really not that large a company. And although most people that are listening to this are going to think, my God, a company making over $1 million, I'm going to get a headache. Well, when you walk in there, it's not going to be as large as you thought. $3 million, I hate to say this, is not really that much today. Now, the reason we're staying in this range, $1 million to $3 million to $4 million, is you get the most bang for the buck. In other words, you're going to buy it for a certain multiple. You'll build it up over a five-year period. And you're going to find there's companies and people out there that will pay you much higher multiples, like public companies, things like that. So you're paying maybe four or five for a manufacturing company. You may get 20 or 30 times. You not only will double the net in the five-year period, but you'll also get many times the multiples when you sell it.
You know, and out of all the times we've talked, you know, we talked about when you're looking for a business, you want something that's doing well, that's going to bring the investors back a bigger return than something he's going to get on real estate. But this really is kind of the first time we've talked about an exit plan. And you're talking about once you get the business and it meets these criteria, it's good for the investor, it's good for you. So you do have a plan in building it up over 5 years and possibly reselling it. That's a great way to go.
Well, you know, you talk about investors versus real estate. I don't mean to tie it in here, but I'm going to talk about a few times over the next month, and that is in California, especially Southern California. I can't speak for San Diego, but Orange County down here, the cap rate or the return that people get is running between, what, 2 and 3%? So on $1 million property, you're getting $20,000 or $30,000 back. When somebody comes in on one of our deals as an investor and they put $1 million in, they don't have to worry about the cap rate being 20% because we're going to protect their $1 million value. When they get out in 5 years, they'll get their $1 million back plus a percent. Now, in the state of California, when they have cap rates of 2 or 3, the people with poor memories have to remember that the cap rate's going to go back up to 9 or 10, which means that real estate that's worth $5 million at a 2% cap rate is worth $1 million at a 10% cap rate. For all of you out there buying real estate today at these stupid cap rates, unless you get in and out of your property soon, I will predict that you are going to lose your shirt. Absolutely.
Today.
That's right. You're buying at the wrong time. And I've been around the real estate market in California for 30-some years, and all I can say is I've watched these things go up and down. And I watch the pain that the people have, excuse me, when it drops like that.
Is the market about to drop, do you think?
I don't have anything to say about that. All I'm saying is it is a safe investment to bring your real estate in on our deal from that standpoint. Number 17, experience skills required. Can be managed by an absentee owner. That's what you're really looking for. You don't want one where you have to be a rocket scientist or you have to have extensive specific industry skills. And keep in mind, what happens is when you go out, the person running the plant for you, if you're going to be an absentee owner, will know that business. So I've been there 10 years. You're making $3 million a year. So he knows what he's doing. You don't really have to be that skilled to run that thing as long as you don't decide to run the plant yourself. Now, when you go out, what's going to happen is if you find one that requires extensive, specific energy skills, the owner of the business, the seller, is going to drive you nuts because he's going to say he doesn't want to sell to you because you don't have enough skill, industry skills, even if you tell him that you don't plan on running it. In fact, as soon as you tell him you're not going to run it, he gets nervous because he thinks that you ought to come in, move in next door, or live over the plant and be there every day. If you tell them you're not moving, I mean, at the time, if I own many companies, I had people ask me that. I said, you know how many companies I own? They said, well, aren't you going to move here to run this? I said, I'm not planning on running the company. And they'd always look at me funny. And then I'd come back to them and say, look, let's remember how we started the conversation. We're paying you all cash. Since you're getting all cash, why do you care? I said, oh, okay. You have to keep reminding them, we're paying you all cash. In other words, don't have the normal worries that the normal seller has. You don't have that worry.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to take the business back. You're leaving with all dollars. If you don't want dollars, we can pay you in pesos or yen or whatever you want, euros, and any offshore bank account you want it transferred to. Okay, number 18, owner financing. Now, 18, 19, and 20 are owner financing areas, and again, once you get over $1 million, very few owners will finance. If they do finance, they usually want something security, usually like real estate. What happens most of the time is with owner financing, they either won't go long enough or the interest rate's too high or whatever it is. What you're going to find is you are better off with an investor. In other words, the amount that you have to pay an investor every year, or we have to pay the investor, is going to be much better than having a financing. And then also, even though financing can add to the value in certain categories, which we're about to talk about, the thing you have to realize, owner financing, and say you have financing of 20, 30, 40% of the company, and then you have debt. You have payments to make every month. There's nothing nicer than owning a business and not having any payments to make. When you want to expand, you can expand out of cash flow. You don't have to go out and borrow more money. But it's in here because what I want you to do is when you go in, if an owner said he will finance, or in your first meeting, you're talking about financing, sometimes you're going to run into financing that you just can't beat. So you ought to consider it.
So if we've got an owner who's willing to finance 40%, that's a plus.
Right. And also number of years, again, the plus would be over 15 years. Now, today, you're going to run into a lot of them that are up to 5 years. You're going to find the arithmetic never works. When you get in the range of 6 to 10 years, well, 10 years you're getting close, because what's happened over the years, the last 10, 20 years, is banks and other type groups are now willing to go 10 years. Back in the days when I was teaching and we had a 15-year run, we had gotten most of them to the point where they were going 20 years because we were the only ones teaching and all of our people were buying most of the company. So we got to the point where we had an average of 20-year financing. Now, fine, but get up to 10 because what's going to happen is we're going to suggest to you that basically you go 10 years and what you're trying to do is amortize the thing over a longer period of time. In other words, I want 10 years to pay it off, but I want to amortize. In other words, as if it's going to be 30 or 20. What happens is, though, you have a balloon payment in 10 years, so you have to worry about balloon payments. If you haven't experienced balloon payments, what you should do is go on a regular amortizing loan. Okay, owner financing over 15 years is good. Once you get up to 10 years, the arithmetic starts to work. When you're under 10, the math is not good. The next thing on owner financing is the interest rate. And what we're trying to do, again, if you go to the tables and check to see what happens to your payments, when you're up over 10%, your interest is going to eat you up. And what we're trying to do is get to the point where on the average we're at 6 or under 6, no matter what the economy is doing. back in the days of Jimmy Carter, most of the financing by banks and stuff was, what, 22-23%?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the owners were over 10%. Since Jimmy Carter left, and it's just been building houses, we've always been under 10. So please don't bring Jimmy Carter back.
All right, let me ask you this. Tell me if I'm thinking right. We've got 18, 19, and 20
right.
owner financing, but what if we're going the investment route where we're not even going to consider owner financing?
It's none in all three areas.
So that's going to drop my points. That could have been potentially 12 points to bring my score up to a high mark.
Right.
But so that's minus 12 points right there if I'm
okay.
considering it.
What you're getting at is if you have 40% financing on the thing, 60% owner financing, you're going to own more of the company. Okay? And if you set this thing up right, the amount of owner financing cost will be less than the owners that you have on that. That's the math on that.
So it is a better deal if I could get the owner financing in?
If you have good owner financing. Again, when I was making that up, I was balancing it out against what the cost is, max cost, on investors. Again, did I do weighted values to get it down to that point? No. So I don't know how accurate it is.
All right, so if I'm working with you and I'm thinking in my head, if I'm going to go find a business and I'm going to use one of your investors, I'm not even going to really consider 18, 19, 20.
What's going to happen then is if nobody considers it, the highest score we're going to have is 88.
Right, and that's still pretty good.
Okay, but on the one where we had an 86, they do have owner financing. On $5 million at a $14 million price. So they picked up points in this area. That was a good example. I can't give you the details of that because it's privileged with the person I'm working with, but it turned out that the financing was a five-year deal, and it ended up with what he was structuring. It was going to cost between two and three times as much cash flow as the investor.
All right, so just don't worry about it.
No, you should worry about it, but the key thing is to tie in there. I did not want to leave it out.
That's important. All right, 21.
21. Tying the business was for sale. When you find one that's been around over a year, you know it's been around over a year, 6 months to a year, you're going to find it's overpriced or some basic things wrong with it, especially when you then find out that 20 people have tried to buy it. And when I find things like that or it's been on the market a long time, I don't do anything. Almost all the business I run into, because I am well known in the industry, which anybody else can be also in a short period of time, you're going to find they're going to feed you businesses when they first get listed. Or if you're going out looking for a business, you're going to be working with an owner that didn't think about selling. So you're under 2 months. And what's going to happen is the less time this thing's been listed, the easier the owner is to work with. And the reason for that is if he's had a number of buyers come by, they've wasted his time, they didn't have the money, they didn't know what the hell they were doing. And what happens is, the longer it sits around, the tougher they are. So when I see one that I know has been around a long time, I don't pursue it. The business plan. Now, if I couldn't tie anything else in, I would have tied this in and made this 20 categories.
Mm-hmm.
Business plan. What happens is, we have people at the well and put together 1 to 10 pages, and the reason they're doing that is they're trying to keep it simple. I keep telling them, we need a $1 million business plan because the minimum investment is $1 million. If it doesn't look like $1 million, whatever that is, you're not going to get the investors to buy. They're not going to do anything. The reason I take it up to 30 pages, I try to set that as a standard here, that you better get your business plan up to over 30 pages or you're going to have a problem with the investors because you're not giving them enough information. You're asking them for $1 million and you're giving them something on the back of an envelope. This is $1 million. They're not going to mail you $1 million for a couple of pages of nonsense. So it has to be over 30. Again, I've seen a lot of them at 40 and 50. We're not going to go up to 100. 100 is something you put together in a business plan when you're doing a startup or you're doing a turnaround. This is a good business. A good 30, 40 pages would be just great. Not would be. It is just great.
Okay, let's go to 23.
Okay, 23, the purchase contract. Again, it's the same thing. I have a person I'm working with now. Always his examples. I'm always working with somebody that's violating some of these. And what he did is he went to a friend of his, a broker in Florida, and got her to mail him or email him the standard contract they use in Florida. The thing is about 8 or 9 pages. Well, you're buying a $7 or $8 million business, and you have a 10-page offer to purchase, or 9-page or 8-page contract. I'm not an attorney, but I went through the thing. There was probably missing 70% of the key things you need in a contract. Now, what the brokers do when they're using these contracts, they're using them basically like a letter of intent. In other words, it's trying to spell out the general areas, but it's really not a purchase contract. Until you start to get up to a number of pages, and again, everybody's going to worry, my God, if I have a 30-page contract from an attorney, this is going to cost me a fortune. Well, as I've said in the seminar, on the cassettes many times, if you're buying a multi-million dollar business and you go to an attorney and tell him you'd like to pay him at the close, he's going to say yes. If he doesn't, he's stupid. Why? He's going to pick you up as a customer. I mean, wouldn't you as an attorney like to pick up a customer that has a business doing $3 or $4 million a year?
Sure.
Of course you would. The same thing with a CPA. Will they wait? Yes. And for those of you listening to this and saying, well, I couldn't get an attorney or CPA to do this, well, you ought to change your attitude. You ought to go talk to your mother. All I'm saying is, I've been doing this for years, and very few people have ever said they had problems doing it. They just hadn't tried it before. So, purchase contracts.
Or do you have samples of purchase contracts from over the years that could be used as a...
No, I can't use them.
You can't.
One of the problems I run into is, back in the days when I was teaching, we had a standard contract in the book that you have,
right,
by attorneys. As I took that and modified it and came up with a 16 or 18 page that I use, when somebody come to me wanted to see one, I would send it, and I'd always get a letter from their attorney telling me that I was practicing law. I wasn't charging for it, but, okay, just like letter of intent contracts. Some of the people we work with, Michael said, can I get a sample of the letter of intent? I said, it's one page. It spells out what the price is, the terms, whatever you've agreed to in your meeting. It's a non-binding agreement before you go to purchase contract. But there is no standard. I mean, when you do run into a standard, you're going to find it's one of these that is almost a purchase contract, which defeats the purpose of what you're trying to do. So the purchase contract, get those numbers up. Okay, sales for the past 3 years. Again, we're talking about sales and profit. Even though we talk about other things going through these 25, there are two things that people keep missing. You and I have had problems with a couple of people that you've referred to me on these two things. In fact, we've had more trouble with these two things than anything else. And that we're looking for something that's increasing each year. I want to see for the past 3 years an increase each year. The further you get away from this, if you have one of these things that's flat and level, if you have up and down, or if you have a downward trend, up and down and downward trend is a kiss of death. The chance of getting by me or even talking to an investor or getting an investor interested is literally none. The other problem is if you're a buyer and you find one that has up and down sales and profit for the last 3 years, the problem you're going to run into, there's a good chance if you give up 50% of the company to your investors, you're going to have a year where you're not going to have any income, or the amount of money the company makes is not going to be enough to pay the investors, and you're going to have to pay them some for next year. So you and your family, what a business where your share may be $1 million to $2 million a year for you and your family, you may find you're going to have years in there where you have no income. Hello? Incidentally, if you have a 90 score and you have a downward trend on sales and profit, the chance of you getting an investor to do anything is zero. Or up and down, it's zero. In fact, we had one person that finally quit calling me, Michael. I'm not going to mention his name.
Okay.
He went through two of these and got all the way down the end, and the last numbers I got were up and down, and I told him on each one of them that it wasn't going to fly. So he quit calling me.
So 24 and 25, you can forget everything else above those unless you've got increasing every year?
Yep. Now, flat and level, can I sell that? Probably not. To be perfectly honest with you, the first 25 I developed did not have pricing on it. But I then had to figure out, I have to put that in there. But it took me a while to get those three, and I took three others out. So if that becomes a problem, I will remove it and put the other three back.
This makes it really easy. This shows you the criteria you need to be looking for. And
there's nothing wrong with owner financing. Years ago, that's how we did it. I mean, we had owner financing. Owner financing was tough to get. It's still tough to get.
These owners, if they're financing, what's the standard? Is there, the interest rate?
Well, they're probably down around 6 now. There's some around 5. But let me tell you what it normally is. Zero. Once you get over $1 million, finding an owner that really wants to finance is zero. They don't really want to.
Yeah, they want out of there.
The problem is I'm trying to encourage the people I'm working with, the buyers, to look into it, because if it is there and you can work it right, it benefits the buyer.
Yeah, it doesn't hurt to ask.
Well, or discuss it. And most of the time, all the times I've done it, probably the last 20, 30 years, I get in there and say, okay, you said you might finance. Guys say, yes. I said, okay, what's the conditions? He'll say, well, I want your firstborn, your secondborn. I want a bank guarantee for 15 times. Whatever the hell it is, you will not believe what they come up with. In the next 5 minutes, I say to them, look, you're not going to finance. That's obvious. So let's go to an all-cash price. All-cash is good also because I'm going to ask for a lower price. If there's no broker in the transaction, say I went direct. Say I decided to do what I always recommend, which is go through the different journals that you have at the reference section of the library, look up the companies, write letters to them, just like one of our stars doing now, our college professor. At the end of the first week, he had 9 businesses making over $1 million just writing letters. At the end of the second week, he had to cut it all off because he was inundated with all the meetings he had to go to on these deals. Very few of them fell apart. Then, a couple of days ago, 2 of them came up, and he had mailed to them 2 weeks ago. So he said, asked them, he said, you're interested in selling? They said, yes. They said, well, why didn't you call me sooner? They said, well, we just had them on our desk. We just kept looking at them, and we wondered, should we do this or not? And then we thought, my God, I've had this business for 20 years now. I bought it for this much. I can probably sell it for this much, all cash. I must be crazy. I said, the ones that don't say that, went home that night and said to the wife, you know, we had somebody write us a letter and say they'll pay us all cash for our business. What do you think of that? And the wife will say, when are we leaving? I will say, well, I didn't call him back. She'll say, you're sleeping on the couch. You call him back and meet with him.
That's funny. I'm going to call him and eventually. I'll wait a little bit. But I've talked to him before, and maybe he'll do an interview with me on how he did that. That'll be...
Well, let me tell you, just on sending out letters, I've used them as an example with everybody I get to talk to. I keep telling them how well that works. I mean, I've known how well it's worked for many, many years now. In fact, when you look at my program, brokers are down number 17 or 18. And that was a few years ago. 20, I put them at 21. As far as the problems they cause. And Sally, did you read the other thing that had to do with our financing?
Yeah, okay, you want to go over that? I've got it in here, the Art Hamill Business Investment Group thing.
No. Okay, I'm going to be changing that. I'm going to be putting in categories. I was just trying to, off the top of my head, cover all the different things that I keep talking to these people about. This is going to give them something that they can give to the seller, they can give it to the broker, and I think it'll take some of the pressure off.
Right, I got you, yes. They can use this as a tool.
Well, it'll also help them understand what's going on. And then Israel, because a lot of them would come back and say, can we get a letter? I said, if I have to send a regular letter, they're going to ask me for a guarantee. I said, I can't do that. I said, you have to give me the business plan, you have to give me the contract, and I have to do all the other stuff first before I can say anything as to whether I'm going to work on it. And then until I go to the investors, I can't tell you whether they're going to do it or not. But you'll know within the first week.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I got to. Just to start on this one, too, because the other problem I was running into, that's talking about having a letter that wanted to talk to me, I figured maybe it'll take some of the pressure off. Maybe it won't. I don't have any idea.
There's an interview in the section of the audio recordings at Hard to Find Seminars. It's with a business buying expert. His name is Art Hamill. If you go back to my site, hardtofindseminars.com, and go to the product section, along the left side in light blue, you will see a list of topics. Look for the one that says business buying. Click on that link and you'll be taken to about 7 hours of exclusive interviews with Arthur Hamill. Arthur Hamill has purchased multi-million dollar businesses, over 200 of them in his lifetime, and he will tell you how to do the same thing. It's some fascinating content, and I wanted you to know about it